having a picture recorded.
Now?
So, welcome to our departmental colloquium. Nice to see you all. And our neighbor,
outsider.
Our friendly neighbor, he's a modern Indologist.
Welcome. Okay.
Thorsten Tascher. I'm very pleased to welcome Naf Geldes from the University of Ghent, the Institute of Seminar or Department
Research Center.
Research Center for Comparative Kulturwissenschaft. Vergleichende Kulturwissenschaft.
So it's better in German than English.
Yes. And he's a research assistant there. I was there about 6 weeks or so ago. Mm. And they are trying to set up an India platform on a European level. They already have something in India, in the state of Karnataka, which is really quite flourishing. But this is an interesting thing. And I was talking to the head of this research center, Professor Balagangadhar. And he had convened this meeting of various European Indologists and Indianists, and then he was introducing his doctoral students, and Raf Geldes came up to me and said he's doing this work on the European works on India and the genealogy of European Indology, really, would be.
And
I said, oh, very nice, you know, this used to be one of my topics, and I was really very pleased. And then I said, why not come to Heidelberg? I'd like you to meet our group of scholars. And he was very keen. And so I think, in a way, we're going to start this. The India platform hasn't taken off yet, but it may start with this group of scholars. It may start on a doctoral level, because so far we had one other doctoral student, Sarah Clairwood, who's also from the same research center. She came about 3 or 4 weeks ago and presented something very interesting on the politics of conversion and secularism in contemporary India. Now, maybe you'd like to know something about Raf Geldes' checkered career, or very interesting career. He started off doing a BA in African Languages and Literatures at Cambridge, but then went on to do something in Comparative Science of Cultures, an MA on Learning Machines Cognitive Skills in University Education. But then his interest in India became much more pronounced, and he went on to do an MPhil in Modern History at the JNU, where the thesis was on the mantras of anti-Brahmanism, the colonial experience, and indigenous debates. And now he's doing his doctoral thesis. Title of the dissertation is The Genealogy of Colonial Discourse, Indian Traditions, and the Limits of European Representation. And it should be submitted in about 3 months?
Four
months, right. So nearly in the last stage. And so we'll ask you very nice questions.
Thank you.
And he's published already one important publication in the Economic and Political Weekly on the mantras of anti-Brahmanism, so that is from the MPhil dissertation. That was in 2003, and the second publication in Comparative Studies in Society and History, which is one of the very important social science journals, on the genealogy of colonial discourse, Hindu traditions, and the limits of European representation, and that has just been accepted. Yes, he's presented various seminars and conferences. But another thing that I should mention, because otherwise I'll be talking all the time, just two more things, is that he's working on a European Studies database, India database. This is a bigger project, and it's to do with the European writings on India. Maybe we'll hear something more about that. And he's part of this European Union Asia Link project. This is development of human resources and strategies for education on the stereotypical images and cultural differences between Europe and South Asia, which is so very good. What some of you may have heard about is a series of conferences that has already started. I think we're into the second or third one.
Second one,
which will be taking place in January. It's a 5-year conference series, international conference cluster, Rethinking Religion in India. The first one was last January, and the next one is also going to be in January. This January in Delhi, and it's being organized really by the research center in Ghent. And is the Carnatic Center also involved?
Kuvempu,
in Karnataka. Right, I think those are the more essential aspects, and we'll hear the most essential things from you.
Thank you.
We look forward very much to your talk.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As you can see, the title of my presentation will be Orientalism and the Indian Traditions, Continuities and Discontinuities in the European Discourse on India. Now, I would like to start with a more general reflection, which is like more or less the background of my research. We all know that in the aftermath of Edward Said's Orientalism, which was issued in 1978, postcolonial scholarship has insisted that the 19th century Orientalist scholarship, Orientalist representations of India, that this was a corpus of knowledge that was implicated in and reinforced colonial state formation in India. However, there has been some recognition in South Asian scholarship on the difficult points, the crucial point I find, that the colonial descriptions of India built upon an existing pre-colonial European discourse. Of course, there's the work of Professor Dharmapal Frick, there's also Jopo Rubias at the LSE, there is the work of Donald Lach, the multi-volume work of Donald Lach. Nevertheless, there is as yet little scholarly consensus, I find, or indeed literature, on the core issues of how and when these colonial descriptions, these structures came to be formed, or the intellectual and the cultural access, the milieu in which they grew. Now, this genealogy of colonial discourse is the subject of my presentation, and its principal concerns are the formalization of a conceptual unit in the 16th and 17th centuries, which we call Hinduism today, and the larger reality of European culture and religion that shaped the contours of representation. So I will be arguing basically that Hinduism, or the notion of Hinduism, even though it was not called Hinduism yet, this notion of a unified Indian religion was developed at the European libraries and universities in the 16th century, and this continued into the 17th century. Now, the colonial discourse, the 19th century British colonial discourse especially, employs a single category of analysis, that is Hinduism, to classify a heterogeneous collection of Indian traditions. So there's a vast collection of Indian traditions. All of them are grouped together under the name of Hinduism. And what does this image of Hinduism consist of? And I will elaborate upon this in 7 points. First, Hinduism would be the native religion of India. 2, this religion would be the province of a priesthood, the Brahmin priesthood, like Catholic Christianity is ruled by priests. 3, their books would be the Vedas, as vital to Hinduism as the Bible is to Christianity. 4, these Vedas harbor a monotheistic religion. 5, the priests would keep these monotheistic insights hidden from behind the curtain of the Sanskrit language, like the Latin was used in Europe. 6, the priesthood masterminded new religious laws, which were not present in the original. And then finally, these new modes of worship would be their major source of revenue. So to sum up this colonial description of Hinduism, it consists of 2 distinct branches. One branch identifies an ancient and monotheistic religion in the Brahmin scriptures, referred to as philosophical Hinduism. The second branch points to its corrupted manifestation in idolatry and ritual, and this is referred to as popular Hinduism, folk religion sometimes. Those responsible for the corruption from philosophical to popular Hinduism are said to be the priests or the Brahmins. However, the Brahmins hardly can be called a unified group themselves. They do not constitute an organization either. A pan-Indian Brahmanic alliance never existed and still does not exist. Now, in the absence of such an institutional body, it is next to impossible that a religious system or a social religious system with an identically structured set of practices could come into being from the Himalayas in the north to Kanyakumari in the extreme south. In other words, it is far from clear how a loose minority faction of the Indian population would have ever managed to enforce this unified religion upon an entire subcontinent. Therefore, contemporary scholars take recourse to matters of colonial state formation when they explain the development of a unified Brahmanic religion in the colonial sources. So the argument crudely goes as follows. Because the British colonial state had to govern India, they had to collect revenue and taxes, they had to use these unified categories, and these unified categories all of a sudden became a real religion, with the interaction with indigenous forces, of course. Now, in this presentation, I will argue that it is impossible to equate the development of this imagery with the colonial state. Neither did it develop in the British sources. And I will show that the juxtaposition of philosophical against popular Hinduism and the emphasis on a corrupting priesthood as the axis around which both would revolve can be traced back to two distinct images of the Brahmins, both of which were developed in the libraries and the universities of the 16th century. So each of these images, two different images of the Brahmins, each of these images reflects the theological preoccupations of Christian Europe at the time. So the presentation consists, therefore, of three sections. I will first trace the idea of philosophical Hinduism, and I relate it to the first image of the Brahmins, which was developed in the medieval archive, before the 16th century thus. And this representation of the Brahmins reflects the preoccupations of medieval Christianity. In the second section, I will trace the notion of popular Hinduism, which was consolidated in the disciplines of the 16th century. And this notion of popular Hinduism will therefore be related to the preoccupations of early modern Christian theology. I will focus on the Protestant Reformation. The third part briefly outlines how both images were combined in the second half of the 16th century into a unified portrait of the spiritual history of India. And the structural outline of this 16th century representation dovetails in structure and content with the outline of Hinduism associated with colonial scholarship. Now, in my research, I focus on the interplay between travel accounts in four vernaculars in Dutch, English, French, and German, and then how they interact with the European disciplines like ethnography, cosmography, in these four vernaculars. So I've come to the first section, composite image one, philosophical Hinduism. Now, one of the cosmographies which was very influential in the 16th century was the Omnium Gentium Mores by the German humanist Johannes Böhmes. This was issued at Augsburg in 1520. I mean, I want to excuse myself if my pronunciation of the German is very bad, but so this was issued at Augsburg in 1520. Omnium Gentium Mores translates as customs of all nations. Now, Böhmes stands at the beginning of this presentation for two reasons. A large portion of his preface is devoted to a historical outline of the evolution of religion. That is to say, religion in the singular, because it was understood that all Semitic and all non-Semitic traditions, and thus also the Indian traditions, were essentially variants of one and the same phenomenon. that was the homogeneous, originally universal and true religion, which continued only under the name of Christendom, Christianity. Now the author explains it as follows. Whereas the humankind once worshipped the biblical Christian God, the devil made humanity bestow upon idols and images the honor that previously and appropriately was bestowed only upon God. Now, Boomer's analysis was not exceptional. Christianity generally represented itself as the original and only true religion which the Christian God or the biblical God had given to humanity. This theological reflection, or this Christian self-image, took on ethnographic significance because it also structured the understanding of non-Semitic traditions, be they Greek or Roman, and later the traditions in the East and the West Indies. Other traditions were simply devilish corruptions of Christianity. Now, the second reason for why Boomer stands at the beginning of this presentation is the following. He also describes India, and he describes the Brahmins, and he describes them in very favorable terms. According to Boomer, the Brahmins have not yet come to worship idols, and they continue to worship God Almighty, that is, in his case, the Christian God. The Indian Brahmins are virtually represented as a proto-Christian example for the European Christians to follow. Now, this was written in the 1520s, in 1520, and the question is, where did this image of the Brahmin worshipping the biblical God come from? Now, Johannes Boomer, like his contemporaries Desiderius, Erasmus, Thomas More, he was writing at a time of religious turmoil. This was a period that was marked by anti-clericalism, and this sentiment found lucid reflection in the literature and popular culture of the period. The estates of the realm, they divided society into three. There was first the clergy, the nobility, and then the common man. And religion was supposed to be the realm of the first, the clergy or the spiritual man. Now, the priestly sacrament of ordination was the most distinct division, the distinct manifestation of this division, which gave the priest an infallible character and elevated him to a higher plane of perfection and divinity. In turn, this perfection empowered the priest to mediate salvation. So sacerdotal or priestly asceticism and saintliness were the ideal. Evidence of the fact that this ideal often was not met informed the anti-clerical sentiments prior to the Reformation. In other words, the theological claim that the Church of Rome provided an exclusive path to salvation provoked the creation of a negative mirror image long before the Reformation. Also before the Renaissance. A deep-rooted and cultural suspicion of the priest. And these voices of dissent, they were expressed at the grassroots level by various spiritual movements in the Low Countries. There was the Devotio Moderna. In England, there were the Lollards, etc. All of these spiritual movements, they highlighted the sacerdotal, the priestly ideal, that is penance and a frugal inner spiritual life. Associated with, I'm trying to explain the context in which this developed, of course. Associated with the literature of this period is the exemplum, the medieval exemplum. This literary genre served to illustrate such normative principles by short narratives or anecdotal stories that know of a remarkable constancy in the popular imagination. Now, it is in this distinct literary and cultural context that the Brahmins, the Indian Brahmins, made their reappearance. In this instance, in the Collatio Alexandricum Dindimus, the correspondence or the exchange between Alexander and Dindimus, this was a fictional exchange of edifying letters between Alexander and Dindimus, Alexander the Great and Dindimus. Dindimus was supposed to be the leader of the Brahmin ascetics. This goes back to the Greek sources, to the Alexander Romans. It was written between the 4th and the 6th centuries of the Common Era. And in these sources, the Brahmins appear as a nation, as a kind and gentle nation, righteous and worshipping the biblical God. Passages of this fictional correspondence and especially the sections on the so-called Brahmin religion, reoccur in an enormous variety of edifying medieval sources. Just to give a few examples, in the 12th century, in about 1185, the Italian priest Godfrey von Viterbo wrote a chronology of the world called the Pantheon. Now, the author puts passages of the Bible in the mouth of Dindymus the ascetic, and for instance, Dindymus is made to draw an analogy between Alexander and the biblical Cain, the son of Adam and Eve, and of course the first murderer of man. To give another example, in the early 13th century, the French theologian Jacques de Vitry incorporated passages of this correspondence in his History of the Crusades and Palestine, the Historia Orientalis. Now, the author reproduces the tales about a nation which he calls, and I quote in French, bien digne d'admiration, well worthy of admiration. The people of this nation are called Brahmanes. Now, Jacques de Vitry allows Dindymus the Brahmin to express the good points about his religion, including his vision of God, entirely in terms of the Christian Bible. So, the image of the Brahmins in the medieval sources does not stem from purely ethnographic interests, but it served as a rhetorical device. Scholars like Jacques de Vitry were advocates of church reform. De Vitry, for instance, was closely associated with the Beguines. The Beguines are a lay sister movement which emphasized the inner spiritual life. And his own contribution to these reform movements was his use of the exemplum, in this case also the Brahmin exemplum. So, long before the early modern accounts of India were written in Europe, the portrayal of the Brahmins who lived an ideal, perhaps a priestly or Christian life, had shaped the associations of India in the popular consciousness. Many of these sources were also very popular among the lay audiences. They went through many manuscripts, etc. From the Brahmins living a moral and ascetic life in accordance with Christian principles, through their worship of the biblical God, their knowledge of the Trinity even, their understanding of the Ten Commandments, to the etymology of their name as being taken from the biblical patriarch Abraham. These elements appear frequently enough in the medieval archive to suggest the pan-European imagery, and the image that was consolidated in the medieval archive suggests the following. The Brahmins are proto-Christians prior to Christ or outside the realm of Christianity. As the archetype of the proto-Christian and the embodiment of virtue and godliness, the Brahmin protagonists performed a didactic or edifying role for the moralists and educators, implicitly reprimanding from the outside the state of morality at the inside. So the Brahmin exemplum was exceptionally prominent in the ethnography of the Middle Ages, and like other medieval examples, it served an edifying purpose. It also was constant, it was always the same story that was repeated. I will briefly elaborate upon how this imagery appeared and reappeared in the Middle Ages. In the 13th century, the French Dominican monk Vincent de Beauvais wrote the main encyclopedic work of the Middle Ages, the Speculum Maius, The Mirror of the World. It was written about 1240-1260. Now, the Speculum Maius included the same passages from the correspondence. The Speculum Maius was translated into Middle Dutch in about 1258 at Bruges, including these same passages on the Brahmins. They cross the English Channel and reoccur in Ranulf Higden's Polychronicon, which was the most popular universal history available in the 14th century. So the most explicit representation of the Brahmins in terms of proto-Christians, replete with references to the Bible, appears in the extraordinary popular yet entirely fictional travel account of John de Mandeville, which was written in about 1357. Now, this travel account was translated into virtually every major vernacular language, and it was one of the most important vehicles with which this imagery of the proto-Christian Brahmin traveled all over Europe. So, the earliest European explorers to India in the 16th century necessarily used this conceptual apparatus available to them when they were describing their experiences in India. While represented as proto-Christians, the Brahmins were taught to guard the central aspects of true religion, that is, good morals, faith, and belief in the Christian God. This legendary image of a Brahmin nation had had such an impact on the popular imagination that the choice to single out the Brahmins as a pan-Indian, a unified pan-Indian clerical estate, which they obviously were not and which they still are not, that image had such an impact that the Brahmins were obviously being represented as if they were the priests of India. Of course, they always had a fabled place in European learning and in the popular perception of the East. The foreknowledge of this asceticism shaped the idea that Brahmin referred to someone who strived for the sacerdotal or the priestly ideal. In words, but like the Catholic priest, perhaps not always in deed. As a consequence of which, a second image was soon to arise, would soon arise on the ancient foundations of the first. Now, from the 16th century onwards, the Brahmins become the crafty friars, the evil friars and priests. To put this differently, the cognitive limits of what could be said about the Indian traditions were drawn as follows. They either reflected true religion, which was of course Christianity, for the people in the 16th century, or a perversion of true religion, of course also Christianity. The more Europe learned about the contemporary Brahmins, the more they moved to the other side of the spiritual spectrum, that is, to the defective Christianity in the East. Much like the Catholic friars and priests, the Brahmin embodied the priestly ideal in word, but in the eyes of Reformation Europe, not always indeed. So this brings me to the second section. And I will show that the report of one 16th century traveller, Ludovico di Vertema, an Italian traveller, this report led to the construction of a second image that identifies the Brahmins no longer as a noble nation, but as a pan-Indian community of priests. And basically I will show that the 16th and 17th century representations of Calicut in Kerala, which was described by Ludovico di Vertema, these representations provide a glimpse of the process whereby Europeans continue to transform the East to suit their own expectations. So, I've come to the second image on popular Hinduism. I'm not going too fast, or? No? Okay. In the early 16th century, after the Portuguese rounded the Cape of Good Hope, the Italian traveller Ludovico di Vertema was among the first to provide the European public with a detailed and contemporary description of what would be called the idolatrous religion of Calicut. Of course, there were other sources. There was Duarte Barbosa, there were descriptions of Vijayanagar, but they did not have the impact which Vertema had on the popular imagination in the early 16th century. Vertema claimed that his description was applicable to other places in India, and thus he provided an ethnographic synthesis for the entire subcontinent, on the basis of his account of one specific city on the Malabar coast, Calicut. Now, this short yet extremely influential report would become a standard reference for centuries to come. It was first issued in Italian at Rome in 1510. It's called the Itinerario. Now, according to Vertema, the king of Calicut believed in what he calls the creator of heaven and earth. But nevertheless, he started to worship idols. And Vertema explains why. He says that even though the king still believes in God, he also believes that God transferred the supervision of the world to the devil. Accordingly, the king does not worship God, but he worships devils. Ludovico di Vertema connects the supposed priesthood of this religion with the Malabar Brahmins. And the idol which Fatima observed is described as if it was the Christian devil. Now this idol was most likely an image of Narasimha. Narasimha is one of the avatars of Vishnu, mainly popular amongst the Saur Indian Vaishnavites. Now Fatima refers to the Brahmins as the priests of the idol. And the idol is explicitly described as Satan or the Christian devil. And as you can see, the idol has a... I mean, this is just an illustration I downloaded from the internet. But this is an indigenous representation of Narasimha. The idol is wearing this a crown on its head. Now, Vartema describes the corona or the crown as if it were... as if the idol was wearing the mitre or the papal tiara of the Pope in Rome. So next to it you see the papal emblem with the triple crown of the Pope. Now this would become extremely important because for the Protestants later on this became ammunition to argue against the Catholics. Finally, the Brahmins are said to be amongst them like the most important priests or the bishops in Europe. Now, over a period of less than 25 years, the treatment, the reading of Fatima's work, revised the imagery that had captivated the minds of the intellectuals and the popular imaginations for centuries. This is the moment of the second image. The Brahmin protagonist grew into a lucid manifestation of priestcraft, which was, of course, a pejorative description of the evil influences of the priests. Such a quick transformation admits no easy explanation, but suggests a change of climate which was ripe for conceptual change. Now, while Ludovico di Vertema was writing his observations of Calicut, the Dutch humanist Desiderius Erasmus was writing his Stultitiae Laus, Laws, or In Praise of Folly. This was issued in 1511. Now, this bestseller was a satire of the faults of the upper classes and the opulence of religious institutions that came to function as a catalyst for the Reformation. Now, this was the cognitive milieu in which the Brahmin exemplum was called upon to serve as an edifying tool. This was the milieu in which Mandeville and Boomers upheld the Brahmin as a proto-Christian example to follow. If the Brahmin ascetic reprimanded Alexander's worldliness and greed, surely he must have shunned the lavishness and avarice associated with the Roman Catholic bishops. Now that same intellectual milieu became radicalized, and in short order, the Brahmin protagonist entered the eye of the Protestant storm. Now, I think that it's a matter of a fascinating historical coincidence that the Reformation started at the time that the West and the East Indies were being explored. Originally cataloging the similarities between Catholic practices and the pagan traditions of ancient Greece and Rome, Protestant thought turned its attention to India. Now, Reformation Europe continued to assimilate the Indian traditions, but now to make visible how Roman Catholic Christianity and devilish idolatry, Indian idolatry, were each other's equals. It is in this context, in Germany, France, the Low Countries and England, that a second image of the Brahmin emerges. That is, the Brahmin became the evil priest. And there's only one report, mainly one report that lies at the heart of this polemical vocabulary, and that's Vertema's Itinerario. I will give a few examples. Vertema's work was first translated into German in 1515 by Michael Herr. And Herr was a Protestant translator at Strasbourg. Now, he also wrote the translator's dedication to the German edition of one of the most important collections of the period, which was prefaced by Simon Grineus. And Simon Grineus was the leader of the Reformed Church in Basel. This was the Novus Orbis, the New World, issued at Strasbourg in 1534. Now, Vertema described the vegetarian diet of the king of Calicut. Now, Michael Herr takes up the vegetarian diet of the king of Calicut and describes it as a corruption of religion imposed by the Brahmin priests. Now, he explicitly refers to the Catholic priests and writes that the diet of the Indian king was imposed just like the Catholic priests had imposed dietary restrictions in Europe. Now, this was of course a reference to the Catholic Friday fast, which was fervently disliked by the Zwinglian reformers especially. Writing from Strasbourg, the head was most likely acquainted with the Zwinglian disputation about the lack of biblical foundation for the traditional Lenten fast. This was in 1522. So his analysis of Indian vegetarianism was also compliant with the Zwinglian taste of Grineus, one of the editors at Basel. Indian vegetarianism was thus not simply vegetarianism, but became a priestly corruption of religion. To give another example, the burgomaster of Antwerp, Marnix of Toulouse, wrote satires against the Church of Rome, in French, Le tableau des différends de la religion, the table of religious differences, issued in 1599. Marnix studied theology under Calvin at Geneva, after which he became involved in the politics of the Low Countries. Now, Calicut features prominently when he questions the apostolic lineage that would make the Pope the vicar of Christ on earth. The Pope in Rome, according to Marnix, the Pope in Rome is more easily connected with the idol of Calicut than with the Apostle Peter of Galilee. And Peter was, of course, the beginning of the papal tradition, in Catholic thought. No, so what Marnix writes then, that the cathedra or the throne of the Pope in Rome, which carries the papal emblem with the triple tiara, the Pope with the cathedra with the papal tiara and the idol of Calicut coalesce, they come together into one common antiquarian frame of reference. So this is the quote translated from the French. The same emblem that she alone wears, the triple crown, the throne of the Pope, does not displease that great fool, the devil of Calicut, who has also come to wear a triple tiara. In a fit of insanity, he forgot that in the Olympic pantheon there is only one Jupiter who holds a threefold lightning, that in the ocean on the seat of Triton sits only one Neptune with a triune, that in Pluto's underworld there is but one three-headed Cerberus, and on earth, in the kingdom of the maniacs, one pope with a triple crown. So, these attitudes towards Calicut were not simply framed by the Protestant polemics. They also manifested themselves in the local history of the Reformation. Long before the Duke of Parma recaptured Bruges, Ghent and Antwerp in 1584-85, Luther and Calvin had found a sympathetic audience also in the Flemish cities. The iconoclastic fury, or the Beeldenstorm, iconoclastic fury in August 1566, had left no church or monastery in Flanders undamaged. While writing from Ghent, the Catholic historian Marcus van Vaerneweyck documented the turbulence that rocked the city between 1566 and 1568. Now, Marcus observed the damage done to St. Jacob's Church, to St. Michael's Church, and various places of Catholic worship that graced the city of Ghent. Now, the Catholic historian narrates how the statues in St. Peter's Abbey remained relatively intact, with the exception of a life-size statue of the Apostle Peter. And this image would have survived the attacks were it not for the fact that the iconoclasts had cast the three crowns, the papal tiara, on St. Peter's head on the ground. So they destroyed the crown of the statue. Now, Marcus quotes the iconoclasts saying that they had seen a golden statue of the devil of Calicut with three crowns on its head, which was, of course, a vision that led to rioting mobs to mock the papal crown or the tiara. Now, the fact that the idea that a Calvinist reading of Vertema's report or a graven image that was actually offloaded in the harbour of Antwerp manifested itself in the local history of the Reformation is not only fascinating, I find, but also indicates the propagandistic frames through which the ethnographic information was structured and understood. Now, similar comparisons between Calicut and Catholic Rome can be found in the French polemics of another disciple of Calvin, Pierre Viret. Viret was the most important preacher at Lyon in the 1560s. Calicut not only featured in print, but also in the visual propaganda of the Reformation. For instance, Calicut appears prominently on the Mappemonde Nouvelle Papistique. The Mappemonde Nouvelle Papistique is the new papal world map, which was issued at Geneva in 1566. This was a satirical broadsheet, an allegorical map depicting ceremonial and ecclesiastic components of the Catholic universe, entirely submerged inside the devil's mouth. And then it was surrounded by accompanying letterpress. Now, from outside the walls of the papal kingdom, traders not only bring in barrels of commodities from the New World, the Middle East, Africa, and Calicut, but they also bring in heathen festivals, ceremonies, idols, and relics, visually representing the spiritual corruption of the papal universe. Now, illustrations of the idol of Calicut also played an important part in the distribution of this imagery. And the woodcuts in the first German edition of Verthema's Itinerario were made by the German painter Jörg Breu the Elder. Jörg Breu mainly worked at Augsburg, where the first edition was issued, and he was also known for his social critique of the Church of Rome. Now, the artist followed Verthema's description of the idol and produced an image that anticipated the Lutheran woodcuts of the devil, because this was issued in 1515. And so the idol is wearing the papal crown, and he is devouring human souls, which is an allusion to the Puranic Asura, which was clawed by Narasimha in the indigenous iconography. For the Protestants, this is the devil who is eating the human souls. Now, this image of the idol of Calicut is an anticipation of Lutheran woodcuts, because if you look at the next one, this is a woodcut which is attributed to Luther. It's a woodcut of the Pope Alexander VI, who was possibly the most controversial pope of the Renaissance. And he came to symbolize the corruption of the papacy of that era, and I think it has very similar features compared to who Jörg Breu, illustrates the idol of Calicut. These kind of representations are reproduced in a variety of sources. In the second German edition of the Itinerario, which was issued in 1611 or 1610, the idol of Calicut is again similarly represented, but has it's more like a she devil with female shapes. This is an illustration of the idol of Calicut in Pierre Boisteau's Histoire religieuse, issued at Paris in 1560. So if you look at the evolution of this imagery, they all consistently reproduce the papal crown, exactly like Europe imagined the devil would have looked like. So the development of this second image of the Indian traditions and the Brahmin priesthood associated, because the Brahmins were supposed to be responsible for this corruption, the development of this imagery was not a purely continental affair. Similar comparisons between the Catholic priests and crafty practices, and then the Brahmins who were responsible for it, were drawn across the English Channel. In the middle of the 16th century, the English translator Richard Eden was asked to translate the European travelogues to warm his countrymen for the prospect of overseas expeditions. Now, this work gained him a prominent position in the treasury during the Catholic reign of Mary Tudor. However, Eden's religion had come under suspicion, which made him resign from office that same year. Now, the suspicion that fell on his loyalty and religious affiliations, his loyalty to the Catholic Queen, the suspicion might have come as no surprise. Already in 1553, Eden translated sections of Verthema's work into English, and he betrays his religious affiliations in the margins. Most of these books, the books in the 16th century and in the 17th century, they have marginal annotations, often made by the editor or translator to paraphrase an entire paragraph. Now, next to the description of the idol of Calicut, the translator adds, and I quote, "the Bishop of Rome's vicar at Calicut." Now, it is one thing to note the similarities between the idol's crown and the papal tiara, but it's a whole other thing, like Vertema did, but it's a whole other thing to describe the devilish idol as an Indian substitute for or an agent of the Catholic Bishop of Rome. Of course, Eden was also fired from the treasury. The last work which Eden translated was the entire text of Vertema's work. This was in 1577. And this was the Protestant reign of Elizabeth I. And Eden could now freely express his anti-clerical or anti-Brahmin ethos in marginal annotations. Now, Eden must have seen the similarities with the Roman Catholic priests shining forth from Vertema's pages. To give the most interesting annotations, where Vertema writes that the priests apply oil on the heads of pilgrims. So Vertema writes that there is a pilgrimage and the Brahmins put oil on the pilgrims' their heads. Eden notes, and I quote, "holy oil in the stead of holy water." And the holy water was, of course, another Catholic practice thought to be a corruption by the Protestants. Where Vertema depicts the manner of burning the dead and mentions the sounds of trumpets, pipes, and drums, Eden is reminded of, and I quote, "the canonizing of saints." And the canonizing of the saints was, of course, another Catholic institution disliked by the Protestant reformers. Now, this the city of Calicut served a common polemical purpose in Tudor and early Stuart England. This continues into the 17th century, where it was employed in an attack against the Pope and the Roman primacy. It was used to criticize the worship of images, the authority of Rome in matters divine. It was used to criticize the cult of the saints, the traditional fast, and it was even used to criticize the doctrine of transubstantiation in an enormous variety of sources. Due to time constraints, I'm not able to discuss all these Reformation polemics in detail, but the same imagery also became part of the popular discourse in England and featured prominently in various public sermons delivered at St. Paul's Cathedral in London in the 16th and 17th centuries. So Vertema's work and the translations of his work were immediately incorporated into the European disciplines and Renaissance ethnography and used for polemical purposes. So this brings me to the last section of my presentation. And I will briefly show that from the middle of the 16th century onwards, both images of the Brahmins, that is the medieval picture of the proto-Christian Brahmin, and then the early modern picture of the Karavti priests, both images are combined into a unified portrait of the spiritual history of India. Now, it's important to remember that, of course, this anti-clericalism or anti-Brahmanism was not obvious in Vertema's report, but indicates that the second image of the Brahmins was constructed at the focal points of intellectual life, at the universities and libraries of Europe. So, when European scholarship decides to grant India the privilege of historical progress, and thus when it goes beyond the ancient Alexander sources, it first takes recourse to Ludovico di Vertema's Itinerario. Now, in 1534, the Brahmins of the Alexander sources first meet the Brahmins of Vertema's work in close textual proximity, that is, in the same text. The German reformer Sebastian Franck arbitrarily sets them side by side in his Weltbuch, the Book of the World, which was issued at Tübingen in 1534. Now, Sebastian Franck first reproduces the sections of the fictional correspondence between Alexander and the Brahmin ascetic. And in the margins he writes that the Brahmins are ein Christenvolk, you know what it is, a Christian nation. He further reproduces Vertema's description of Calicut, and like Vertema, he presents an ethnographic synthesis that supposedly applies to the entire subcontinent. So the Brahmins are now portrayed as India's satanic priesthood. Now, Sebastian Franck's method to project Vertema's work to a pan-Indian status and then to juxtapose it with the proto-Christian religion of the ancient Brahmins is followed by many scholars of the period. And I'll just give a few examples. We can trace it in the works of a much more influential German cosmography by a much more famous German cosmographer, Sebastian Münster, famous for his Cosmographia, which was issued at Basel in 1544 and which went through multiple editions. Münster gives another representation of the idol of Calicut, again wearing the triple crown. The same method was used by the French cosmographers of the period. We can both images are combined into a historical outline in the Histoire universelle du monde, the universal history of the world, by François de Belforêt, issued in 1570, and in the Cosmographie universelle, the universal cosmography, by André Thévet in 1575. Now, the pre-Renaissance representation of the Brahmins reflects the preoccupations of medieval or pre-Reformation Christianity. The representation of the early modern Brahmins additionally echoes the preoccupations of Reformation Christianity. The emergence of a structural outline of the spiritual history of India has to be located in the Renaissance ethnographies, where both formulations met. Both theoretical entities are combined into a unified portrait of the spiritual history of India. The true Christianity that permeated the medieval archive is relegated to the past tense or to the chapters on ancient India and superseded by the defective Christianity. And then the decline is attributed to an ideated, a theoretical entity, the Brahmin priesthood, which was the central point in this Renaissance composition. So to conclude, it is a commonplace that the European expansion propelled the decisive shift from the classical anthropological canon to the development of modern anthropology. So beyond what Pliny, Strabo, Megasthenes, the ancient Greeks and Romans had written. Yet at least in the case of the representation of India, the pre-Renaissance formulation was not discarded, but rather consigned to the chapters on ancient India, such that classical anthropology continued to thrive in the 17th and even into the 18th centuries. In addition, both the classical and the early modern representation of the Brahmins reveal but two faces of the same theological coin. From a proto-Christian Brahmin nation, the Brahmins were represented as the crafty priests of India who were still previously they had been Christian. This, of course, further nuances the anthropological shift in relation to the European representation of religion. Of course, the various types of sources cannot be rigidly differentiated, and the attitudes towards India form much more of a continuum than is permitted by the outline which I have given. Nevertheless, the descriptions of India continue to vacillate between both modes of representation. Those who sought to neutralize theological opponents recapitulated, reproduced the early modern representation of the Brahmins. Throughout the 17th century, throughout the 18th century, even in the 19th century, the evangelical missionaries in India used the same structures to argue against popery, what they called popery, or the papal traditions, the Catholics. Secondly, those who tried to show the universality of Christian principles continued with the pre-Renaissance formulation of the Brahmins. In the 17th century, at the end of the 17th century, there's an enormous production of literature which again reproduces this image of the proto-Christian Brahmin to show that actually the Christian principles had been universal once, especially in the debates on natural religion. This is again reproduced. So both modes of representation disclose a resilient analytical format that continue to shape future reports of India. Whereas ethnographic learning was framed to fit specific theological purposes, future travelers to India incorporated this Christian worldview and reproduced these theological assumptions as common sense narratives. Now, just give one example. The first one to bring back to Europe to bring back this image of the evil Brahmin priest who had corrupted Christianity or corrupted the true religion, and for worldly gains, is the Jesuit missionary Francis Xavier in a letter dated Cochin, January 15, 1544. Now, this was an extremely influential letter. It was also the first missionary report in German. And Xavier describes that the Brahmins still remember Christianity, but they have corrupted it, and they make people do sacrifices, and then they use the sacrifices to organize royal banquets. So that's the typical critique of the Protestants against the Catholics. Nevertheless, Xavier was a Jesuit. However, his Jesuit background is very significant here, because the Jesuits were a missionary order that answered to and struggled with that which the Protestants had identified as the ails of the Roman Catholic Church. So Xavier's account of priestcraft in India was set in counter-Reformation culture. But the Catholic and the Protestant responses to priestcraft only differed according to its scope of application. Because all long before the Reformation, there were very strong anti-clerical movements in Europe, but they would not direct this anti-clericalism to Rome in the same way as the Protestants would do. So Xavier was not anti-Rome as such, but his background nevertheless allowed him to structure his ethnography by the anti-clerical formulations that the Protestants had come to use against papal Rome. And these same structures are reproduced, the same division between an ancient monotheistic past and then the corruption is reproduced in other Jesuit sources throughout the 17th century, throughout the 18th century, into the 19th century. An inherently pluralistic context that simply defied the European imagination, energetic, vibrant, made up out of a multitude of cross-cutting traditions, was simply reduced to two binary modes of representation, true or false. In either case, India enacted a normative idea, an idea that propelled the cultural history of Europe. The true or false, asymptotic, because one could never reach the ideal, asymptotic and assumedly human quest for a specifically Christian mode of conduct and faith. So, I will briefly conclude now. There are two points that require comment. First, the international character of the codification of a unified yet entirely theoretical Indian religion. And secondly, the quite obvious fact that this was not a colonial enterprise. Surely, as a word, Hinduism was coined in the 19th century. It was derived from Hinduism, with double O, which was first employed in 1787 by a missionary and subsequent director of the East India Company, Charles Grant. But as a conceptual unit, it embraces the theoretical entities that were combined in the books of 16th century Europe. The Orientalist notion of an unadulterated philosophical Hinduism in ancient manuscripts, monotheistic Hinduism in ancient manuscripts, is manifested in the first composite image of the Brahmins. The notion of popular Hinduism, the corrupted manifestation of this monotheism, is manifested in the second image of the Brahmins and their traditions. Now, while the present genealogy of colonial discourse constitutes only one thread, of course, in a complex history of representation, the mythical Brahmin nation never lost its crucial position in these pre-existing cognitive categories. As the 19th century unfolded, this Orientalist discourse was incorporated into the colonial discourse and implicated in colonial state formation. But the constancy of representation cannot be explained in terms of colonial necessities or the demands of modernity. It cuts across the multiplicity of power constellations that emerged both in Europe and in India over a period of four centuries or more. Now, I would like to suggest that constancy is made possible because coherent theoretical formats continued to operate in the background of the European discourse of India. And these theoretical formats are the Christian theologies, disguised or otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This was a very, very interesting talk. and it's taken me back a number of years, because in this book I've dealt with a lot of these. You have some pictures of Fatima's papal devil or whatever. And it was very interesting to hear. I mean, all that I'd worked on in the 80s and early 90s, to see how you have looked at it from a slightly different angle, although there were a number of things that were that I had dealt with in my book here. One thing I think is that you are, your main emphasis is that India is really being used as a kind of mirror image. It's being used. Mm. I mean, it's, what one's describing is not really India. And that was what I was saying too. But one thing that I think your point is pretty good. I mean, why I was interested in this sort of pre-colonial material was because I had this hunch that there was a change, some transformation occurred in the European understanding and approach to India, from the pre-colonial to the colonial. And what I was, what I found from my study of the pre-colonial material was that there was a more open sort of empirical approach to the diversity, and I wasn't just looking at religion. I mean, because you just focused on religion, I was looking at political formations, social formations, I mean, how caste was looked at, and so forth. That there was a perhaps a more openness, which was which was of course governed by certain structures, because or conceptual framework, but the colonial imperatives were not there, and so they didn't impinge on the understanding of the observed reality. Mm. So what you're trying to say is that there's a continuity from the pre-colonial, from the ancient pre-colonial into the colonial, even into the present day. Yeah. And I was trying to show that there was a kind of break. Or at least you can talk about continuities and discontinuities.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. I mean, but I also talk about discontinuities
I think this is important. I mean, I've learned a lot from your talk, but I mean, I could say a lot more. Yeah. But since this is all very familiar to me, I think there must be a lot of other questions from the audience.
You were talking about the intellectual atmosphere in which that construction of Indian religions and Indian Hinduism was taking place in the 15th and 16th century, and that it was like an atmosphere of competition between Catholic Church and American Protestant denominations. And so against that background, well, it is clear that the motive is clear why India is used and why Hinduism, that Indian religion is used as a narrative, as an idiom in the European discourse. Can you say something about the context in which that was transmitted in the later periods? Why or how was that image of popular Hinduism on the one hand and philosophical Hinduism on the other hand, and what significance did it have in the later, perhaps the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century? Was there still that rivalry between the denomination, between Catholicism and Protestantism, when was there a point that perhaps the Christian idiom was becoming less overtly Christian, but more a general conception? How
did
the context of the debate change?
What I try to show in my dissertation is that On the one hand, these two structures continue in the theological debates in Europe. So, but there are two movements. That's one movement, consisting of these two structures. As for your question then, how does this continue? Well, the Protestant critiques against Catholicism continue throughout the 17th century, and they continue in the 18th century. And the Enlightenment critique against religion ultimately derives from the Protestant critique against the priests. So, yeah. And in that context, this image of Calicut, especially Calicut, is repeated still in the 19th century. Then the first image of the Proto-Christian Brahmin. And 17th, I mean, I mentioned that those who want to show the universality of Christian principles, they continue with that image. Mm-hmm. And who are the ones who want to show the universality? In the 17th century, those people who want to emphasize the spirituality, the universality of Christianity, are those thinkers who argue against revelation. So what they try to show against Christian revelation, for instance, the deists, they try to show, look, it is not necessary to rely on revelation and supernatural intervention from God, because the Bible was a supernatural word from God. It's possible to have Christianity or true religion on the basis of natural reason. So then they refer again to the proto-Christian Brahmins, because they have had aspects of the true religion without revelation. So then you have the Quaker movement in England. The Quakers even went further. They said, like, oh, you can find it in the spiritual light within. And they published an enormous amount of pamphlets in which this correspondence was again repeated. This is a correspondence, a fictional correspondence of the 4th century. And we're talking about the late 17th century here. This continues in the 18th century as well. So that's the first movement. So these two structures continue. But then within that, what I try to show is that, as you said, like, at some point this becomes less Christian. What I try to show is that, yes, surely this becomes less Christian, but it only looks less Christian. Because it's reformulated in neutral terms, especially from the middle of the 17th century onwards. You can see that.
How would you place Ziegenbalg in this? Because he, I mean, of course, he's on the other coast. He's on the Romando coast, so he doesn't have much to do with Calicut. But he has a different approach. I mean, firstly, he doesn't have real real sort of relationship with the high caste Brahmins. It's more with the Shudra,
Ziegenbalg is the works that I have read are he has all these collections of letters from letters which are written by Ziegenbalg, and then letters which he received from people to whom he had sent a questionnaire. If you look at the introductions, I mean, he describes the Brahmins as the evil priests who have corrupted the true religion.
Yeah, but then he's dealing with the Pandarans as well.
Yeah.
And there he's saying that they are leading pious lives, that they have an understanding of the true religion.
Sure, yeah.
I mean,
it's
about Lumen Nakbari. And that this, I mean, he doesn't associate them with the devil.
Yeah.
He's just saying that they have perhaps been waylaid. One doesn't. After his last work is in 1710, then he returns to Europe, and after that he doesn't write anymore. There's a theory that maybe he was, in a way, so influenced by the religious practices that he, in a way, internally becomes converted. There are people working in Holland who's, I'm not sure whether they've discovered anything, but they are not, he is very complimentary about the religious the religious devotion of the, I mean, of the scholars, of the practicing priests.
Yeah.
I mean, and but these would not be the Brahmins.
Yeah.
These are more belonging to the sort of the Shudra grouping, but they have their own priests.
Yeah.
Basically, I this goes along the same line.
Mm.
What you were focusing on, and I found this very interesting, was the university construction, so to say, in the 16th century, bringing together these two images, and then through the education that people received, and through all kinds of cosmographies, whatever, spreading that idea again and redistributing it through society. Now, if you look at the studies that have been done on, and there has been a kind of surge in studies on the construction of Hinduism, and who invented Hinduism, to take Lawrence's, I think it was formulation. I was wondering what works like the Nobili, who after all gets into a problems with his own church because he emulates Brahmins. What his works, then there's Will Sweetman's work on this this one English 18th century English author, early 18th century English author. So in how far, the question for me in that sense is, what role did people, I mean, much of this was the shaping that people got when they are in Europe. Now those people, and during the 17th century these were still relatively few, who get there and come to really, you know, not be traders and really don't care who's buying my whatever I'm selling, my cloth or whatsoever, but really talking about those people who get involved with religion, whether it is Dinobili or this, what's his name, Abraham
Kokiris.
These kind of words, in how far does anything change about that formulation, or are they trying to fit reality to the formulation, or is reality intruding on it?
It gets very complex, but I try to show that they try to fit reality into those structures, especially when you look at Rogerius. The references to the biblical Jews in that work are like amazing. So everything which he appreciates in the Brahmin religion, what he calls the religion of the Brahmins, everything what he appreciates is traced back to the Old Testament. Arguing that look, the Brahmins, they had been once they knew the true religion, and then the notion of religious corruption, when he describes the contemporary practices, is still exactly the same. Now, it is of course true I can't argue, of course, that over a period of four centuries there is no change. There is an enormous amount of change. But what I try to show is that change happened within the larger framework that remained constant. Also, for instance, when Ziegenbalg no longer talks about the devil, for instance, the notion that the priest is the one who corrupts the religion, this idea goes back to the Reformation critiques against Christianity, but actually it already goes back to the Church Fathers, because the Protestants have taken it from the Church Fathers. That notion becomes secularized. It becomes reformed. The devil is left aside, but nevertheless, the Brahmins as a priesthood is still held responsible for corruption. And the recent work on the Enlightenment in Europe, for instance, the Enlightenment critique against Christianity. It was not a critique against religion, it was a critique against Christianity most of the time. I mean, also shows how, like, in Europe itself, the criticisms are reproductions of Protestant critiques. For instance, the work of Barnett, S.A. Barnett, I think it's at Manchester. So within that context, that same Enlightenment critique against the priesthood is also used in India at the 18th century and 19th centuries. The deist, William Jones's critique, is a deist critique. But what do the deists do? They in the 17th century they are arguing that the Brahmins were once truly Christian. That's why Jones is looking for the biblical connection between the Brahmin to the Brahmins. So. in that sense, I think that there is a continuity, and I do believe that they try to fit, but they were of reality into those structures, but they were, as time progressed, they were of course better aware of the details, and there was much more information and going on. I mean, right?
The other question, and I mean, you might not be, this is more something that I started to think about. I mean, criticisms of priesthoods is something that is certainly not specific to the European tradition. It's something that you find practically everywhere where you have anything that approaches a priesthood. I mean, the jokes that exist all over the Muslim world about the mullah, the hoja, or the labai, or whatever it is called in the respective region, are exactly one type of this criticism of a religious class that manifests specific religious functions.
In India, you have it too.
Exactly, and that was what I was coming to, because exactly in the 16th, 17th century, and especially in some of the parts where you had missions, such as Dinobili. Dinobili was in Madurai, and that's one of the big Nayaka kingdoms. And in Telugu literature of that time, you have a very, very interesting parallel where the after all, traditional Sanskrit theory of the Yugas is used to criticize Brahmins. And you have all those images of Brahmins in the most ridiculous manners of behavior, right? And being basically just out for being fed, getting everything from the rulers who, after all, get punya, get merit out of it, of giving to Brahmins. And all the time, you get these sentences, well, we have to do that because that's how it's supposed to be. But you, of course, know that in the Kali Yuga, those Brahmins are really just the worst thing that could be. So you have this whole narrative of degeneration within the priesthood, so to speak, criticism of the priesthood as being degenerated from what it should be and what it was in the past. And I'm wondering in how far, for example, somebody like Veschi or Dinobili, who were, after all, relatively close to circles where exactly those ideas flourished. And there's one of the most fascinating things, I'm not sure whether anyone has yet noticed it, but in the 19th century you have Abbé Dubois' work, and he describes a drama being performed where a Brahmin is kind of ridiculed. And from what he writes there, I'm pretty sure that this is indeed a specific drama. I'm not sure whether he has actually seen it or takes a description from somewhere else, but whatever it is, it's a particular drama that Sanjay Subramaniam and David Shulman described in their book about the Nayakas, where you have a description of a Brahmin who's being fed. It's a Telugu Brahmin and a Tamil Brahmin coming together at one of these places where they get fed, and it's an absolutely ridiculous description of them, where the Brahmin, you know, wants to get inside the room to get his food, and then the person at the door says, no, you have to wash first, sir. And then the river is too far away, so he tells his son, come, we go behind the next tree and you pee, right? And it looks as if we have washed. And it's really an absolute riot of the Brahmin and how badly they behave, even though back in the past, of course, they were good, right? But what is now left of them. So I wonder in how far such things kind of come to reinforce each other.
They select these. But Dubois, you know that Dubois used pack curved ears.
Maybe it comes from there, so right? But I found it interesting. If you read the description, wherever it came from, if you read the description, it sounds so similar to that drama that I can't.
The observer is selecting certain things, you know, so that he can use it for his own argumentation. So there's also a selection of certain.
Of course, but there is something that he can't.
Yes, but then, of course, reality is always so multidimensional. There's always something that you can, if you want to prove a certain a thesis, then you can always do it. I mean, especially in a place like India where you have everything, you know, you can say something black or white.
Yeah, but I was just wondering about that possibility of a kind of dialogue.
I have not done any extensive research on that, but during my MPhil, I read quite a few of the Islamic descriptions of Indian traditions. Of course, I read them in translation, but what I thought was interesting, and I'm not sure whether I can make like a general claim about that on the basis of what I have read, but what I thought was extremely fascinating is that if you look at, for instance, Al-Biruni, or if you look at the Aini Akbari, and etc., the way the Muslims share the notion of like the biblical corruption, yeah. So that same structure is there in their representation of contemporary traditions. Where they differ from the Christians is that I might be mistaken. This is purely hypothetical, so you can tell me when I'm wrong. But the notion of ulema in Islam is supposed to be he who's the one who guards the religion, if I'm not mistaken. The notion of priestly corruption is not as present as this is in Protestant thought. As a consequence, in the Islamic descriptions, the Brahmins are continuously represented as those who guard the true religion, and corruption is there because of the masses. In the European sources, corruption is there because of the priests. So, where they agree in their theologies, the descriptions agree. Where they disagree in their theologies, the descriptions also disagree. I mean, that's from what I have seen, at least, but I might be wrong.
Wonder if Aini Akhtri has such kind of description of ulema, because it's written by Abul Fazl, who was trying to establish the authority of the court.
Sure,
The ulema, and then many works that were being written in that time, they were written by the ulema themselves.
Okay,
So they all obviously wanted to project themselves as students for the rights of the Muslims. But what interests me in the new work is that, as if you are taking it as a valid question, that who invented or who constructed Hinduism, you know, and if there was a construction in the first place, then it has to be located in the pre-colonial history of the European university and the academy. So that, for me, raises the question of agency, basically, if it's not to be located with the Indian population. But if you are addressing it somewhere else outside India in the European academy, so how do you respond to that? And how these different studies on critical formulations and the religious discourse and all that, how was that really, you know, what Professor Fick said, the change, how was it transformed into what has been described as Orientalism?
I'll answer the second question first, because that's less controversial than the first one. How it was transformed into Orientalism? Well, one of the things that I also try to show is how this imagery, how it develops, how it becomes consolidated, how it crystallizes into the standard account in Europe that was reproduced in an enormous amount of sources. And if you look at what for Edward Said was one of the early Orientalist works, Herbelot, La Bibliothèque Orientale, if you look at Herbelot's work, which it's like a dictionary, you know? So if you take all the entries that have something to do with India, you put them together, you almost have the colonial representation of Hinduism, and you almost have the colonial representation of the caste system. He just uses different words. He does not talk about caste, he talks about tribe. But, the description is exactly the same. So what I try to show is that by the end of the 17th century, because Herbelot is 1697, I believe, by the end of the 17th century, this image is consolidated, it's crystallized, it's there. And it's reproduced in the encyclopedias, in the dictionaries, in the first so-called scientific dictionaries, etc. So that's how I would relate it to Orientalist discourse. As for the first question, I don't believe Hinduism was invented. I still don't believe it exists. There is an enormous variety of traditions in India. It has always been like that, and it is still like that today. Somebody who is doing something, I don't know if you want me to elaborate upon that, but theoretically it exists, and people fill in the form Hindu, Muslim, Christian, etc. But
so you would say that religion, would you dispute the fact that there's religion in India? the category religion doesn't apply to India?
It applies to Islam and Christianity. I think it applies to Islam and Christianity.
So it's the phenomenon of religion doesn't apply to whatever is non-Islamic and non-Christian.
Just to throw that in, it links up with your earlier comment on the Muslim thing. Because one of the interesting things, if you read the translations, at least of Al-Biruni, which I wasn't aware of either, which were made, I mean, Sakho's translation is late 19th, 20th century. And he constantly speaks about the religion of the Hindus in the translation, the religion of the Hindus, religion of the Hindus. If you read the Arabic original, it's Adyan al-Hind, it's a plural. Right, the religions.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
And that's and apparently it was already an earlier work, a geographical work, Shahristani, I think. Bruce Lawrence has worked on it, and already the plural is there, right? So he was drawing on a tradition to speak about the Adyan that exists. If you want to translate Deen as religion, right? The various ways, traditions, religions whatsoever that existed amongst the Hindus as a kind of geographical category. And that is very interesting how that then in 19th century European scholarship gets rolled into the general idea of that there's one. Right? Maybe we can take Buddhism, and because Al-Biruni speaks about texts that apparently are Buddhist in a few instances, so maybe somebody like Sakho was ready to grant, okay, we have Buddhism, we have Jainism, and then we have all the rest, which is Hinduism. And that is the interesting, is another interesting difference. And I mean, what you said about the ulama, I think the ulama is a very difficult topic in Muslim history. And at some places, they have been criticized as, you know, at least the lower ranks of the ulama, those who are kind of considered to be half-baked, they have generally received a lot of criticism, at least from the popular side. Who kind of sense that they are the one-eyed amongst the blind, right? and they have, of course, received criticism from those on top who thought they were the seeing. But yeah, there's an interesting comparison that you make, that the idea of the priesthood as something fully corrupting may not be there in those areas. And it would be an interesting thing to get really.
It would be interesting to
make a huge project. Kind of.
I wish I could. I can't compare.
Yeah, well, this is something collaborative,
But when you say that the term religion does not apply to Hinduism, isn't it like a sort of this Orientalist concept of or a Semitic concept of religion, which you're talking about, that there has to be a central prophetic figure, a central text, sacred text. More or less codified form of rituals and beliefs and practices. So then, what is your categorization of religion?
I don't have a problem answering the question. I would love to answer the question, but it will take us like for a few hours. No, it's a very. I don't think it depends upon a definition of religion, in the sense that if knowledge about the world does not depend upon one's definition. I mean, a definition is a definition. A definition is me defining a word, and then I say, that is what I mean with that word. That's a definition. So, it does not give me any knowledge about the world. So I think whether you classify different phenomena in the world into the same set religion, we call it religion, but we cannot call it piff-puff, whatever, but we call it religion. I mean, whether we classify them in the same set does not depend upon the definition I've given to the set, depends upon my understanding of the phenomena. And to understand the phenomena, I need a theory first, a theory of religion. And so you have to develop a theory, I believe, in order to know whether two phenomena in the world are exactly have enough commonalities to belong to that same set. So I would not call it a Semitic definition Semitic definition of religion. I think that there are enough dissimilarities to presume that they do not belong to the same set. Then the onus is on those to show that they do belong to the same set. Because there are so many dissimilarities, isn't it? I mean, between Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and Indian traditions, there are so many dissimilarities. Why would we necessarily have to put them in the same set? I don't know.
So, you are contesting the notion of the definition of religion, even if that religion if we use religion to define Christianity or Islam, I mean, that is...
That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. You can use the word religion for the Indian traditions, but then I would not use it for Christianity or Islam. I mean, I don't mind you. I mean, it's just the word. But the interesting thing is that religion, the way it is used, or the common usage that has been throughout Christian history, I mean, dogma is not religion, I presume. So, I mean, it might be religion, I don't know, but I would presume that it's not. But then in religion, in every European language, we have a word for religion. The Christians themselves have always described themselves in terms of religion. The Indians have not, I believe. I mean, they have never recognized religious rivalry between themselves and other traditions. Of course, at this moment they do, but they did not do in the 16th century or in the 17th century. All traditions lead to truth. But they did not see religious rivalry between themselves and the Christians. So I think that there are good reasons to use the word religion. I see a lot of like eyebrows going off.
I disagree with that. You don't have the idea of rivalry. I mean, you read medieval Tamil hagiographies, and of course we can start a discussion on whether we should call them hagiographies, but the texts about people who are important religiously, and you see, I mean, mudslinging is the least, right? You see stories of... There's one very important figure.
I think he was meaning rivalry between Indian religion, or Indian practice, and Christianity.
Well, the idea is... the problem would have been for an 11th century writer in Tamil to know Christians, right? For him, there was a certain set of possible choices. And that set of choices is what, I mean, I don't expect a medieval German writer to write about Shinto traditions, right? So in a sense, but the point is you have stories that tell me this is a great devotee of God, because one of the things he did, and this is a story that is told until now, one of the things he did, he went to that town and cut down all those followers of the Buddha and took all the statues of the Buddha, melted them down and made a big Vishnu idol out of it. Hmm. And you have lots and lots and lots of these stories. You have lots and lots and lots of stories that tell you can't go get any moksha if you follow this way or this way or this way or this way. It's in itself, I think, a European trope to pick out those depictions that say, oh, you can reach God through every path, right? Mm. There are lots of traditions in India that have said, no, you can't. And some of them, like Vallabhacharya in 15th century North India, actually said, it's not only about, you know, following Vishnu. It's even if you are from this Chaitanya fellows that you don't really stand much chance to reach moksha, right? Mm. So there is, it's in itself, I think, a trope in European scholarship to associate Indian traditions with a certain amount of, the images that we get from Ramakrishna and Gandhi and so on and so forth, that you can reach the roof through all kinds of ladders. And there's a very interesting tendency to ignore practically all the set of sources that is there for religious conflict, whether it's inscriptions that tell us that one temple and the other temple start fighting against each other for temple land, and then there's an inscription in Chidambaram, for example, of one Shura king who makes the claim, I took the statue of the little god. And in Chidambaram you have the big problem that a very important Shiva temple and a kind of quite important Vishnu shrine are in the same space. They're like 5 meters away from each other in the same temple ground. And we have an inscription where one Shura king claimed, I took the statue of the little god, meaning Vishnu, and threw it into the sea. And later on, you have a depiction in a poem which says, well, the statue of Vishnu lies in a way that the head of Vishnu is towards Shiva's feet. If you look at the Vishnu statue nowadays in that temple, it lies the other way around, with the feet towards Shiva. And we know that in the 16th century, the dynasty, who were Vaishnavas, made that temple independent, this small Vishnu shrine in that huge Chidambaram Shiva temple, which is so important for the Shaivas in South India, is independent in administration. since the 16th century, since the dynasty that was Vaishnava, and we know from them that they apparently turned the Vishnu around, so that the feet now point towards Shiva. There's all kinds of little, if you amass them, at least that's from the area that I know, for the Tamil area, if you throw them on one pipe, it's actually a huge amount of textual evidence, starting in the 7th, 8th century at least, at least within a certain section of society, of a tremendous amount of religious rivalry, that, well, it's very systematically, whenever you start coming up with it, I see people retracting from it, immediately almost. And it's something that fascinates me, because I think it has to do with one of the strands of how we have come to study India. Mm-hmm. But, that's a wider discussion.
I think we could get it go on, and so we should stop where we can go on at the time, because I would suggest that we go for a meal in, it's called Bellini. For anybody who would like to continue talking and feels hungry, suggest the best place would be to go to the Bellini. Our gathers is just here for, yeah, it's leaving tomorrow at 2-ish.
Yeah, I think I leave at about 2 something. Yeah.
Yes, so he will be here tomorrow during the day, but it would be nice if any of you would like to join us. We'll be going more or less straight to Bellini. But thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Recorded. Well, I have to say that.